The busier you are, the more intentional you must be, said Michael Hyatt.
Welcome to Coach to Scale, how modern leaders build coaching cultures. I'm your host, Matt Benelli. Join me as we build a community of like-minded professionals who share the belief that effective coaching improves the performance of every team member. Our mission is to help leaders become better coaches. The Coach to Scale podcast is sponsored by Coachem, the world's first AI coaching execution platform that leverages evidence-based coaching to increase quota attainment. And with that, let's get started.
And being intentional certainly applies to designing and building winning teams, something about which today's guest is very, very passionate. She spent the better part of almost 20 years building winning teams at Salesforce. Currently, she's Vice President of Global Sales Development and Inside Sales at MongoDB. Christina Smears, welcome to Coach to Scale.
Thank you, Matt. I'm thrilled to be here.
Thrilled to be here also and to have this conversation with you. Really looking forward to it, and I think the audience will too. We're going to go down a road that needs to be gone down. So let's just start off with what I'll call the myth buster question that we ask our guests. Christine, a lot of myths in the business. You've come across them at every step along the way. By the way, just as an aside, I mentioned at the onset here that you spent almost 20 years building winning teams at Salesforce. You started as an AE, right?
Less, yeah. Entry-level SR, sales rep.
Even less. Subhuman. Yeah. And you made it, right? All the way up. Okay. Super impressive. So there's a lot of myths out there. What's a myth that you've heard consistently time and time again that you think is misguided, misunderstood, or maybe even complete BS?
I think there's a couple. I would say I've got two. So one of the myths that I think I actually believed in when I was sort of younger in my career and still see it play out today, but no, it's not true, is the myth that you should hire more of you. So if you're really good, especially in sales, if you're a really good sales professional and you have the criteria to be successful, go replicate yourself. Go hire 12 of you. I actually had a leader once that said, oh, we're putting you in a leadership position because we want 7 more of you. And I was like, actually, that's not what actually makes winning teams. And by the way, that also isn't real life or doesn't scale. So in my opinion, I think the best teams are where I hire people that are different than me in skill set and background and strengths, frankly. And that's how you create an amazing team, that sum of the parts is better than the individual. So I think that's one, is don't hire replicas of yourself, because I don't think that's a real thing.
And I love what you said there, that, hey, you believed it for a while, right? So some of these myths, I think I act like, oh, I never believed that. But we did. We did for many, many years. And then it's like, oh, maybe it's not exactly that way.
Yeah. Right? And then someone opens your eyes usually. You hire someone that's different than you, or you work with someone that's different than you and thinks different and processes information. My best example is I had a guy on my team. I'm a list person. So I would give them the list of everything that we needed to accomplish. And he took it and he made the list a calendar by date and did it like almost like a timeline and milestone. It's a small thing, but the way he processed information, I was like, actually, same end result, maybe even better. And you just process it differently. That's actually really eye-opening for me. So that was number one. Number two, and this is specific to sales. So for your listeners that are in sales or sales leadership, which I imagine is a lot because you're a bit of a sales legacy yourself, is that you have to be extroverted to be in sales. And that is a big myth in my mind. I think some of the best salespeople are introverts and process information and are really good listeners. Both can excel. And by the way, you need both on a team. But I think that's a myth because introverts can get the most out of customers. They're really good listeners. They process information differently. They're more thoughtful. And you kind of need an introvert to balance out an extrovert like me, for example, in a team meeting, so that you get the best of both worlds.
Well, yeah, and those tie back together. Hire more of you, hire more extroverted people. I know that if they hired a team of me, the leader would want to light his or herself on fire. I mean, it's shut up and listen, right? And so you talked about people being good listeners, a lot of times extroverts aren't good listeners, right? They have the search engine on their forehead. When you're talking, sharing a story, they're thinking about the story they're going to tell you back.
Yep.
I resemble that remark. Yep. Excellent point about both of those. So in order to avoid those mistakes or falling into the myth of hiring more of the same and only hiring this one type of person, this extroverted person, what's a framework that guides how you do what you do when you're building teams?
Yeah, I think I look at it a couple of ways. There's always going to be your must-haves. So I'm not saying you go out and hire people that have none of your required skill sets. Like, that's not what the path I go down. I typically have a required skill set list, and I really try and focus it on skills and not experience. So I'll give you an example. One of my number one things I look for is drive to be number one. You might have been number one in a training organization, in a law firm, in a sales board, or, you know, a sales technology company. It doesn't matter. But like the drive, the fire, I'm looking for that in some capacity. And there are questions I'll ask that go down that path. But there's a kind of list of required skill sets, no longer than 5 to 7 things, you know, that I know that if you don't have these innately, the learning curve is going to be quite strong. If you're in sales, which is what I, you know, my organization that I run, and you don't have a, you don't care about being top of the board, you don't care to have that fire, you're probably going to be pretty miserable on a sales team. Like, you got to have that drive to be number one. So there is sort of a required ingredients list. Let's just say that. However, when I'm looking for the other pieces, I'm looking for people that have different, what I call superpowers. And I steal this from a book called Multipliers by Liz Weissman. It's an amazing book that talks about multiplying. Really good leaders multiply themselves. Not so great leaders will diminish others. It's just sort of a theory she has, and I really believe in it. But one of the things she talks about in the book is that everyone has a superpower. Everyone has something that they naturally do well, probably better than most. And sometimes they don't even realize it. It probably comes up a lot when you're in performance reviews with managers. Oh, you're really good at X. And you're like, yeah, but isn't everybody? Or maybe your friends will say it about you. You're really good at that. And if you're not sure, there's a bunch of exercises you can do online to go find your superpowers. The first step is ask people close to you what you're good at. Anyways, once you identify the superpower that you have, you typically know something that maybe you're not so good at. I call it the kryptonite. So when you're designing teams, you want to think about what is your superpower, what is your kryptonite, and how can I complement that? So I don't want to hire 7 people that have the same superpower as myself. I want to hire people that maybe fill in the gap on the kryptonite, for example, or they might actually have different superpowers, and I'm looking for different things. So it's actually a question that I always encourage people that when you're interviewing with a company or you're deciding what company to go for, ask the hiring manager, what superpower do you need on your team that you don't already have? Maybe you need someone really good at data and analytics. A superpower could be empathy, by the way, really good at EQ. A superpower might be operations. It might be having that extrovert. I need the cheerleader on the team. I don't have it right now. What's the superpower you need on the team? And then one, it helps identify, like, will you be the person to make the impact that they need? But two, are they aware of what they actually have on the team and need on the team, and you're pushing them to think about that? And that actually helps you decide if you want to work for them as well. So I think the combination of being intentional about knowing yourself and your superpower, knowing what you need on a team, and then how you complement each other is really an important skill set. And there's a bunch of exercises you can do as a leader to identify what you currently have on the team as well, which are fun exercises to do as well.
So Christina, with that said, how do attributes like curiosity and learning fit into where you're building your teams?
Oh, it's ever. I mean, curiosity and learning is everything. So I'm a student by nature. That's definitely something that's in my personality. I like to learn. Education is something I'm super passionate about. It changed my station in life by educating myself. I'm the first one in my family to go to college. I put myself through school, and it really changed my world perspective and my opportunities as a result. So I believe wholeheartedly in learning, and that it never stops, and that at every level, which is why I'm a podcast fan and I read a lot of books, is just because I believe that, like, kind of developing yourself, one, it inspires me. And two, I think it makes me a better leader and a better professional, hopefully a better mom and a human as well. But I think so learning for me is a passion and something I see in other people. And I look for companies that value learning and development. I look for companies that invest in enablement, because I think that is a sign of them bettering themselves and their leadership team and all of that. I also think curiosity, especially in sales, is like the difference maker in a good or a great sales professional. And you know this because you've been in sales for so long, but the best sales professionals can ask questions and keep asking them and keep asking them. I'll give a shout out to a great training I went to. I don't even know if it's still around, but there was a guy named Barry Ryan, and he used to do Barry Ryan curiosity training.
Selling through curiosity.
Yeah, and it was truly a whole training on curiosity. And one of the exercises he made us do, this was probably like 18 years ago. One of the exercises he made us do is he read a transcript of a customer call. And then we had to write questions, and we as many as we possibly could until we couldn't write anymore as he was talking. And my goodness, it built like a crazy muscle for me that now I can ask questions. And a good friend of mine, David Premier, he does cerebral selling. I'll give him a shout out. David Premier taught me that you can practice curiosity at, like, for example, the grocery store. When you're checking out with the clerk, how often do you ask them questions about their day or what's the busiest time of week? Or it probably never. But if you're new in your career and you're like, how do I practice curiosity in a safe place? Try the grocery store. It's a great place to start.
There's a fantastic book. I'll send it over to you, but I want to mention it. Written by, I think it's Brian Glazer. He's a Hollywood producer. And so he's got nothing to do with sales, really, like in the way we would think it. But he was a Hollywood producer, produced some of the movies that everybody knows and loves. His side is, partner in crime was Ron Howard. And so his whole thing is about curiosity. And he used to have what he called curiosity conversations. And one of the rules was he would never have a curiosity conversation with someone in order to land a movie. It was always to learn about stuff that down the road he believed would inform the movies that he was making. And so when he first started out, he was a nobody, he didn't know anybody. He would just reach out to interesting people and you're like, wow, you're an expert on this, UFOs. Let's talk about UFOs. And then when he became famous, he was able to get access to other famous people. And it's just a fascinating, fascinating book. I'll put it in the show notes, but we talk about curiosity. I think there's so many different ways to practice it. Like you said, you talked about education changing your life, changing your station in life. Is it just university schooling? What do you think about if someone came to you and they had a lot of the attributes that you're looking for, but they didn't have a university education? Are things changing there?
Oh, I definitely think they are. I think they are. And I think that plays into the conversation of how do we diversify the people on our team in terms of skill set, background, way of thinking, obvious diversity, gender, URM, all of that. I think there's an amazing opportunity to widen our scope by not limiting ourselves with just college educations. I do think it's changing. It's interesting. I value education. But I don't care if you went to Harvard or a community college. I don't care if you got to get your MBA or you took two courses in sales on the side. I think it's the muscle of learning that I'm looking for and that I value. For me, I grew up in a like lower income class family. My mom was a preschool teacher. My dad was a truck driver. My whole family never got exposed to education. And like many people, my whole family was military. It was like you were going to go in the military. That was like the path you were going to go down. And I learned at a very young age that actually I really like learning. I like school. I'm pretty good at it. And I had some really amazing teachers that identified me early on that were like, actually, like she should go into a different track. And it totally changed my perspective, my life, frankly, because I absorbed information. And I wanted to read and I wanted to access information quickly. And it exposed my life to what else was possible. It's actually how I, like when I think about how I got into sales and technology sales, I was talking to a group of interns the other day and I would have never guessed, when I was a kid that I was going to be in tech sales. One, I wasn't techie. I didn't know a thing about tech. Two, I wouldn't have called myself a salesperson. Like I didn't know that sales is basically conversation and humans. It was kind of an intimidating career path for me. But there is, once you open your eyes through education, which all ties back to, I went to a, in my university class, We had somebody come speak to us from a Microsoft reseller about working at a Microsoft reseller and what that looks like. And that's how I got my first internship. And it really opened my eyes. And then I talked to the sales professionals and I was like, how much do you make? What? This is amazing. This is life-changing. Right. So I just think curiosity, being open and educating yourself can really change the doors you walk through in life.
You know, you talk about the teaching. I mean, a lot of people say like really love teaching, but let's face it, economically, it's not lucrative. It's just not. And you need, you know, people need to make money to pay their mortgages, whatever. But what we do, what your managers do, what your sales enablement folks do, what your pre-sales team does, it's teaching, isn't it?
Oh, I feel like I can't tell you enough. The analogy I always give to people, and this is actually for people who are listening that have maybe done only sales leadership or have only done customer success leadership. Let me give you one big pro tip. It's not that different if you go teach something else. If you go from a CX manager to a sales dev manager to a solutions manager to a manager of finance analyst, it's still teaching. The subject you're teaching changes. Maybe you're teaching math, but now you're teaching English. But it's still teaching. That leadership is teaching and the subject changes. And I was intimidated by that for a long time. And I learned actually the motions, the playbook, the content might change. The expertise in what you're talking about day in, day out will change. But the actual framework of teaching, still the same.
Same with what you sell, right? It's you sell at Salesforce, you sell the different products that Salesforce has developed over the years, or you know, now at MongoDB. Selling is selling the nuts and bolts of it, right?
Correct.
The bones?
Correct. Absolutely. And if you learn how to do that, you can really apply it to anything. Actually, recently we've hired people that were actually public school teachers and now want to get into sales. That's like a new path that we're looking at because they know how to comprehend, communicate information. They have a presence in a room. They, you know, that's all part of it. So it's very transferable skills. And I think sometimes we can get stuck in, well, I've done finance for so long, or I've done cybersecurity for so long, or I've done this path that can I really transfer industries? Yes. Yes. It's not that different. It's the story you tell and the skills underneath. And yeah, you might have to take a step down in order to get into that industry originally, but I can't tell you many times in my career that's paid off. Where you take a step down to go back up, it really does benefit you.
Amen to that. I have a whole conversation just about taking a step back to take a step forward. That might be good to do sometime. So, Christina, what are some topics on which managers can focus with their people, with their employees, that may not be as commonplace as you'd like or expect?
I think the superpower kryptonite conversation would be probably unique. I don't think a lot of people do that today. And I think having that conversation with your team would absolutely be part of it. I think being intentionally designed about your team would be a huge part of it. I think the other one is, I don't know if this is commonplace, but I'll say it anyway. I would say one of the ones that I use a lot is empowering people through innovation. So what I mean by that is, as a leader and a leader of leaders, depending on what level you're at, I think a percentage of your time should be spent on making the business better, which is innovation, no matter what level you're at. Maybe it's 5% if you're an individual contributor. Maybe it's 10% if you're a first line manager. If you're a third line manager, 30% of your time should be spent on innovation. And what I mean by innovation is you're doing projects that change something. Maybe it's a pilot. Maybe it's a role that you're trying. Maybe it's a technology you're piloting. But you're trying something new. I believe in a bias for action. So rather than sitting here and talking about, oh, we should do this differently, we should do it better, well, why don't you go try it? Let me empower you to do that. Let me give you recognition for doing that. And let me reward you, whether it fails or it succeeds. So I think a bias for action and having valuing movement in an organization, which is really just innovation. Innovation can be this big word, like I got to do a big product release, or I got to really change the name of this org. Or it actually can be, hey, I'm going to try this project and everyone's going to put their fingerprints on it. And that, I think that empowers people. I always tell people it's a resume bullet. So if you participate in innovation. Yeah. It's a resume bullet you'll use later on. And I think you can do that at any level, where you're an IC and you raise your hand and say, hey, I need to innovate this, or your manager delegates something to you. Projects create opportunity. Take on those projects, do that innovation. You'll be a better person for it.
Resume bullet. Love that. Where do goals fit in here? And what I mean by that is literally the manager with his or her IC, individual contributor, and saying, hey, so what are your goals? Like, what do you want to, why do you come to work every day? How important is that?
Hugely important. I mean, you have to know their why. You have to know their why, and then that's actually helping them nudge them to do innovation that aligns with their why. So if I say, hey, what's your professional and personal goal? It's the first question I ask in whatever one-on-one I have. Like, kind of, I ask two questions, like status check on kind of personal and professional happiness level. So I'll give you a range, and I'll say 10 is like, you couldn't be better. You're the perfect health, happy mentally, physically, you couldn't be better. And 1 is like, not good at all. Where are you at? And I'll ask them a range. And they don't have to elaborate. They just can give me the number and then let me know where that at. That helps me understand, okay, how much of a gap are we at? And what do we need to do to fulfill that or raise it a little bit? So maybe we're a 5 out of 10 because I'm really stressed out about my health right now. Okay, so how can we help you with work-life balance? How can we squeeze in a walk or whatever that health might work for them? Might make sense, but I think understanding where they're at, and then that's the first step. The second step is, what do you want and where do you want to go? I'm doing a QBR in 2 weeks in New York, and my leaders are all coming in. And the last slide I actually ask them is, what do you personally want to learn more about in the next 12 months? Yeah, what are you going to do for forecast? What do you do for goals? But what do you personally want to learn more about? Selfishly, I want to know that. So when we think about innovation, how do I give you projects that tie into what you actually care about, right? So that's part of it. But it also helps them introspectively think about that too.
So, and I can only imagine that you actually spend time on that slide. I will also tell you that my experience has been the leaders who are checking the boxes have that slide. It never gets talked about. They go sideways when the forecast slide comes up, and it's not where everybody wants. But I think you would say and pound the table that it's important to make sure you're spending time on that slide too.
Yeah, right? And as a business, there's a selfish reason for it. The reason I'm doing it is not just because I want to learn more about what you want to learn about, but because I want to make the business better and assign you projects, but I want you to be in it. I don't want to assign you a project that you don't care about and don't want to learn about, so you do kind of a mediocre job. I want to assign you a project that you already wanted to learn about and build a resume bullet around, so that it's a win-win for both of us. So I think you just have to think strategically about it.
When you talk about bias for action, can you go a little deeper on that? Maybe even give an example. I mean, I know what you mean. You can explain what bias for action is, but where I'm coming from with it is, I had a conversation yesterday with the CEO of a small company, a small services company. And he's talking about, I have this guy, this person on my team, and they're really good. They read a lot of books. They got a lot of ideas, but they're struggling. They're not doing like all the things they need to do, but he thinks they're curious and into it because they're listening to podcasts and reading books and talking about it. My guess is, if I connected the dots, that's all they're doing. They're not taking action on it. What's an example of bias for action?
Oh yeah. I'll give you an example, and then I'll also tell you how you can push people who don't naturally go in that direction. Because I've had people on my team that are ideas guys, but not execution guys. And how do you shift them to that? Because you need both. You need the people on your team that are creative and think outside the box and like, why don't we do this? But you need the doers as well. You need both. And so you need them to be able to bring them over the edge on how you bridge them from ideas to execution. So I'll put that in a back pocket for a minute. But I think what I talk about bias for action is, this is part of my personality. So if we start talking about something, my instinct is, well, why don't we try it and see how it goes, versus analyzing until we're sort of blue in the face. I want to know, is it going to work? Is it not? Well, let's just try it out. So a good example was, back when we were really small at Salesforce, I'm going to say, really small, relatively, like we were a couple thousand employees. Now Salesforce is 80,000 employees. We were small. I ran a team, and we have a sales development team, and we were trying to figure out why the data quality was so bad. And the data quality is really rough, and we couldn't get the right contacts at it. And the reps were spending kind of an hour to 2 hours a day adding data, cleaning up data, and adding contacts from LinkedIn and all that stuff. Now there's a bunch of technology out there that does this, but let's pretend that this was a long time ago. So I said, well, why don't we hire an intern? I was an intern back in school. It was a great experience for me. I got such exposure to tech sales. Why don't we hire an intern? We founded a great partnership with a Canadian university here called Laurier, and we did a co-op program, and we piloted it. We asked for money. It was like a couple $1,000s. Let's pilot this for a couple months. Here's my expected ROI. You write a quick business case. Our head of sales was like, sure, let's try it. We tried it. We did one intern. We saw increase in productivity, increase in calls, and the intern had a great experience. It's now like a full-fledged program called Future Force at Salesforce. It's like hundreds of people every year. So it's pretty amazing that, and the way we looked at it is we were here in Canada, and people who are not at headquarters, this relates no matter if you're in a different country or not, sometimes headquarters can do things and you're like the small little engine that could back here in a non-headquarters office. It's a great opportunity because you can do something. If it doesn't work, no one needs to know about it. If it goes well, you're like the rock star and you're like, I can replicate that and make an impact. So that's just a small example of how you're able to like have that bias for action and just try things. I've had millions of them that haven't gone well, by the way. That's just a success story.
The way it works. Oh, and by the way, if you have a team full of people that aren't all the same, you're going to get different ideas. If you have a team full of people who think one way, then the innovation is going to be stifled, to say the least.
Can I double click on that, Matt? Not to interrupt you, but I want to double click because I think this is an opportunity to highlight one thing. In sales, a good example of this was you like to do events. We'll have a customer events all the time. You'll do customer dinners. You'll do customer, bourbon tasting or wine tasting. You'll do things to like schmooze your customers. It's part of enterprise sales. It's definitely a playbook that we're part of. A really common one is sports games. You take over a hockey game or a basketball game or maybe the Super Bowl, and you have a box and you invite your customers.
You inviting me to the Super Bowl?
Wouldn't that be amazing? That'd be pretty awesome, right? Yeah. Not everybody wants to do that, right? And so as a woman in sales, one of the ideas I had, to your point on having different ideas and piloting them to see if they worked, we started running women in leadership events that were at spas. So you take over the Four Seasons for a morning and everybody got a manicure and a pedicure and you built trust with your customers. We also did private shopping experiences where we took over a Chanel and you had a private shopping experience. That idea only came to fruition because I didn't look like people in the room. Other people on my team wouldn't have suggested it because they probably wouldn't have thought of like, oh, I want to go to a hockey game. Of course I want to go to a hockey game. But actually, if I was your customer, I wouldn't want to go to a hockey game. But you invite me to the Four Seasons of the Ritz-Carlton in downtown Chicago, I'm there. And I'm going to build relationships. The ROI, by the way, was ridiculous. Like millions of dollars in revenue with only $40,000 in spend. Like the ROI was huge. So I want to point that out as an opportunity to think about. If you're running a team and you're like, how do I get diverse opinions? That's just one way to think about it.
Yeah, I hope my wife doesn't watch this. I think that's a great example, by the way. There's a lot of different things. And how do you get someone excited about doing something? If the event is something that they're excited about, they can go run a one-person event. It doesn't have to be always the team doing it. If you're an enterprise rep, let's just say you're an enterprise rep. You're a woman. You're in enterprise sales. Everyone's going to the Maple Leafs games. Yep. Or the Blackhawks games, wherever, and you're like, hey, I'm taking people to the Four Seasons. You're going to get clients, you're going to get men, you're going to get women, you're going to get everything, and you're going to grow your business, you're going to build relationships, and that's yours. Like no one needed to tell you what you needed to do. You just needed to show innovation, show that there's going to be an ROI, and go out and do it.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
I was always dumbfounded and surprised when I would ask somebody in like a skip level or QBR, hey, have you thought about doing this? Have you thought about doing an event at the Four Seasons, whatever? And they say, oh, I didn't know I could do that.
Yeah.
Oh, did someone tell you couldn't? And so it hit me later than I wanted to that there's two types of people. There's the people that ask for forgiveness instead of permission. They're the ones that you have to talk off the ledge with the expense report, like, dude, calm the hell down, right? And then there's the people who don't spend anything because they don't think they can. And so you got to make sure the expectations are set. No one's reading your mind. I don't know if you've run across
that. Oh, gosh, yeah. I mean, it's like, and I got to say, like, as I'm a rule follower. So I fell into that. Like I wouldn't have, when I was a rep, if someone would have given me the permission, I probably would have thought about it. I might have asked my leader if I felt comfortable with them, but I wasn't going to go do anything unless it was in the policy or it was part of it. And I've had to learn over time that there's a gray area there and it's not as black and white. And like, that's something I developed in my skill set. But I think be conscious, if you're a leader and you're listening to that, think about people on your team that you may need to nudge a little bit to work in the gray area and to be comfortable with that.
I think that's super important. If we were on the same team, you'd say, I don't know, it's not in the policy. And I would say, don't worry about the policy. Just, you know, you're good. Just bring the revenue in and don't, as long as no one gets arrested and goes to jail, we're okay. So Christina, let's talk about onboarding for a minute. How do you look at onboarding new people onto the team? How do you work with your leaders to do
that? Yeah, I have a couple different philosophies when I think about onboarding. It's also, you know, one thing I'll say is if you're new, and I'm new at Mongo, I've been here just over 60 days. It's hard to join a new company and learn all the technology and also learn the, you know, the political landscape, the connections, the clicks. It's you know, how I have a lot of, after being at Salesforce for over 19 years, and I had different careers within that 19 years, I have a lot of new found empathy for people who join companies and are learning the ropes and trying to get familiar. Just be patient with people. That's like my biggest thing. And they've been incredibly patient and amazing here. So I think one, there's rubber balls and there's glass balls. And I did not make up this theory. I stole it from somewhere in the universe and I wish I could get credit for it or give credit to it, but I don't know who I got it from. The way I think about onboarding is that you're going to be carrying a lot of balls in the air and you're juggling all these different balls of like, okay, learning the technology or learning the product or getting my manager on board with me or learning to, you know, learn from my peers or the do the work or talking to customers. There's all these balls in the air that you have to learn about. Ask your manager, what are the glass balls, especially based on the time frame? What's the ball that if I drop and it shatters, I'm in trouble? And what's the ball that's rubber, and if I drop it, I'll be okay because it'll bounce back up? That's the way you want to think about it, and that's the way that I think about it. So whenever I have someone on board, I tell them, like, here's the glass balls in the first 30 days. Try and keep it small, like 2, maybe 3. What's the glass ball? And what are the rubber balls? That like, you're like, I want you to learn this, but like if it falls in the first couple months, it's okay. So the one I always do for leaders, I literally just had this conversation yesterday because I'm onboarding a leader. I have a 90-day plan and I say first 30 days, your glass ball, hearts and minds. You got to capture hearts and minds. Connect with your team, face in the place, take them out for dinner, get to know their kids' names, their spouses, what they like to do on the weekends. That's your mission in the first 30 days. That's the glass ball. Forecast, that's the rubber ball. You know, customer interaction, that's rubber ball. The glass ball is the hearts and minds. Month 2 is operational excellence. Learn how to run the machine. What tools do you need? What numbers do you need to know? That's the glass ball in 60 days. Because I find if you don't know that after 2 months, people start to question your credibility. You got to know the operations. And then month 3, it's called time to drive. That's when you've earned the hearts and minds. You know enough about the business. Your glass ball in month 3 is you're driving the team forward. You're pushing them on the numbers or the productivity. You've earned the right and maybe have a little bit of credibility and hearts and minds to push them on what they're able to achieve and accomplish. So that's actually where I'm at right now because I'm in month 3 here at Mongo and I'm in time to drive mode. So I follow my own advice.
And when you're bringing people on that are following that month 1, month 2, month 3, do you get a sense of who has a lot of potential, who you can dump more sand in the back of their truck by the way they approach, right? They treat them all as glass balls. And they just accomplish more, they're driven and they're effective. Do you recall noticing anything like that?
I think so. I think there are people that can handle and have the capacity for more glass balls at one time. I think that also depends on experience level. And are they, to your point before, have they done this job before and they're taking a step back to get back up? And those people tend to be able to be like, okay, I can handle a couple of glass balls. I've got it. But I still think as a leader, expectations, be careful with expecting more of that. I would say let them impress you. Expect the worst, hope for the best, and let them, you know, deliver more. Because I think if you come in being like, ah, this person can handle 6 and then they can only handle 2, you're going to disappoint yourself. And I think we have to be careful in expectations with that because that affects their confidence level long term and a lot of other relationship building stuff you do in the first 60 days.
And when you, so when you're interviewing, let's just say you're interviewing leaders, do you have interview questions that you like to ask to, you know, see how they're going to fit in and react and fit into your culture?
Yes. And if anybody's ever worked for me and listening to this, they probably could recite them. Other than the superpower question, I will ask that. What do you think your superpower is and why? That's always a question I ask. By the way, I always give, when you're doing that as a leader, give your own superpower as an example. So it gives them a minute to think as well. That's a powerful thing to do. So like, here's my superpower. I'm going to tell you what it is. And then I'm going to ask you what yours is. But I also think, I like situational questions. And I'm not trying to trick anybody. Sometimes people think that I'm trying to like, oh, what situational question? Is there a right or wrong answer? I'll literally say, there's not a right or wrong answer. I want to hear the way you think through it and the critical thinking skills on how you can approach it. So I've got two. One is you're a leader and someone comes to you and they're 3 months away from promotion and something's happened where it's delayed and the promotion's been delayed another 3 months or 1 month, whatever it might be. And they're devastated. How do you handle that conversation? I'm looking for a lot of different things. I'm looking for EQ. I'm looking for, can you be vulnerable and relate? I'm looking for how can you get them to think big about 3 months in the 30-year career is nothing, like helping them think broader about it. What I'm looking is for someone to have a little bit of perspective, empathy, leadership qualities, as you think through the problem solving of the promotion. You got to wait 3 months. How do you handle that? And then sometimes you get a traditional sales leader, and they're like, pull your boots up and just move forward. And that's not a wrong answer, right? But my follow-up question is, okay, so you say that and they start to cry. Then what do you do? And so really interesting to see people's reaction to that, because that can be really interesting to see, like, do they get really uncomfortable or do they make them leave the room? Like, I've heard all the different answers and I'm looking for like, what is my leadership? How are they going to blend with my leadership style and how are they going to be able to handle that? No right or wrong answer. I'm just learning about the way they think. The second one's super tactical. And this is if you're a sales leader. I'll ask you, okay, so you're about to go into a customer call with one of your reps and it's 5 minutes before the call. And unfortunately you didn't have time to prep, but it's 5 minutes before the call and you're about to pick up the phone and call the customer. And you're like, okay, rep, what's the strategy? And the rep gives you the strategy and you know it's wrong. Like, you know it's the wrong approach. What do you do? And that's always an interesting, do you take over? Do you not take over? Do you ask clarifying questions? No right or wrong answer. I'm just thinking about how they handle. So the 5 minutes before the call is always one of my favorites as well.
I love that one.
Real life, you know, it happens. Yeah. It's real life.
Yeah, and I'm sure you hear a myriad of different answers to that. And like you said, some of them might sound bad off the top, but when they explain why, at least you know there's some thought that's gone into it. And it provides coaching opportunity too in that process. So, you know, we've talked at the outset about building and designing winning teams. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of let's like use the word diverse, like let's building and designing winning teams, building and designing diverse teams?
Yes. I'm super passionate. One of my personal values is equality. And I'm very passionate about diverse backgrounds, diverse teams, partly because I alluded to it before, but my background is not your traditional background you would see in a, I don't know, the 14th floor of a Bay Street, which is the equivalent to Wall Street, Bay Street Tower. Like this, I am not naturally, I didn't graduate from Harvard. I didn't come from an Ivy League. And no dings against people like that either. Like I admire that and they took advantage of that. That's amazing. But I didn't have the same level of opportunity. So I think diverse background, diverse skill set, obvious diversity, so gender diversity, underrepresented minorities, everyone has a different life experience and therefore a different point of view. And you can gather such great kind of nuggets of a potential and productivity through combining that all in a room. So it's a tricky topic because I think sometimes people feel intimidated by it, especially in sales where it's a male dominated industry and they want women on the team or they want people from different backgrounds, but they sort of know the ingredients for success. And well, you know, this guy on the team referred this guy on the team and they're friends and they were both on the leaderboard at the last company. So like, why wouldn't they be successful? So I think that's a very common occurrence. And I've seen there that can work,
But what can work even better is when the best teams are diverse backgrounds of gender and background and skill set, you get creativity, you get innovation, and it up-levels the numbers and the results of what you could produce. And it really does change the game when you have a diverse group of people in the room.
So I'm going to get really real with you. I've had a lot of these discussions. I've learned a lot over my career on this topic. And I know I have very good friends who are very senior leaders who are extremely good people. And a couple of things I hear a lot, and I heard it yesterday. One is, hey, I built this team and it's all D1, Division I, high level athletes. In this case, they all happen to be guys and they're clicking. And, you know, I go, you know, into the bullpen at the end of the day and I think they're getting ready to leave and they're practicing their pitch. And, you know, how do I, you know, bring, let's just say, a sales professional that's a woman into that culture? It could mess up the vibe. And, you know, they might be a little bit more, I don't know, mindful of how they talk, God forbid. But also, is that in the woman in this case, is she going to feel uncomfortable being the only? Yeah. And I think you have a point of view about the only in the room and the only, you know, can you explain?
Oh, yes. I mean, I've been the only in the room for so long, not just the only woman, but sometimes the youngest person in the room too. And I think it's getting better, but I mean,
I used to be the youngest person in the room. I felt like forever. Now I'm the oldest person in the room. But anyway.
I know. It's like a really interesting thing to experience. But my story I always tell is during COVID, I have two daughters that are 5 and 9. And during COVID, I was on a Zoom call. It was my weekly forecast call. And it's sort of 25 people were on the Zoom call. And my daughter, my 9-year-old now, comes around my table and she looks at the screen. And she sees, and she looks at the Zoom pictures, and she's like, "Mommy, why are they all boys?" And I was like, "Oof, that's a good, you just hit me there. That's a good question." And I was like, "Okay, it's most of the time it was 20 men and me." So I've learned some tactics, and I also think there's two sides to this. So one, getting women in the room, it changes the dynamic for the better. I don't think it changes, it makes people uncomfortable. And I think if you hire really strong, amazing, powerful, smart women, they will be able to handle in that environment very well. It is on the leader to build the inclusion muscle. So when there's a woman in the room and you hire them, one, let's take a step back. How do you hire women? One, you don't just hire women because they're women. Let's stop there. I think that is a big myth that we need to bust. You don't just hire a woman to check a box. You don't just hire an underrepresented minority to have someone that looks different on the team. That fails miserably for both sides. So that, in my opinion, so I don't think that's the way you do it. I think it's about giving people an opportunity. No woman wants the job because she's a woman. She wants the opportunity for the job to show that, hey, I could up-level your team because I bring in different perspectives, like a Women in Leadership customer event to go target a woman that you would have never gotten to the hockey game, as an example. So I think we want the opportunity. That's first. You as a leader need to be conscious about giving people who look different the opportunity. And it starts with just having the conversation. The first step is like, I just noticed this, all the people in the room kind of look the same. That's interesting. You know, the first step is being conscious of it. Don't have to action anything. Just be conscious. Start to learn. Maybe ask other people in your network that are really strong women in sales. Hey, how would you go about attracting talent? I just noticed this. Is this something I should look at, and could my results be better if I had a diverse group of people? First step is consciousness. Second step, ask for help. Ask people around you, whether it's men who are passionate about the topic. We have amazing allies that are passionate about the topic. One of our best executive sponsors of the Salesforce Women's Network was a fantastic male leader. How would you go about it? What would you do? What would you do to broaden your scope and try to attract a more diverse talent pool? And the third is be ready for two things, be proactive and be patient. When you're attracting someone on the team that doesn't look like the team, you need to proactively recruit them. You need to sell them on why they should join the organization because no one looks like them. So they probably don't feel as psychologically safe as maybe somebody who's part of that D1 football team and knows all their friends. So you have to be patient. I've taken a year to recruit really strong, amazing saleswomen. And it's just a quarterly coffee once a quarter to get to know me and my values. It's a proactive, long sales cycle. So be proactive, be patient. It has always paid off.
Okay,
so stat I'll just throw out here at MongoDB specifically, the last 4 years, the number one producer has been a woman. Like, and I'm not, and by the way, it's not the majority. The majority of the, we're still working on gender parity across most sales organizations, right? But it's pretty phenomenal that women can be incredible sellers and fantastic professionals, just like a man, but there are different skill sets that they bring to the table that can enlighten the room.
What do you say to the leader who says, I hire the best person for the job. I'm blind to gender and race. I just want to make sure we're in the best position to get to the number. I need to hit the number. Yes.
So my response to that is that you have to widen your pool regardless. There's no way you'll know how you can set records and do beyond what you do if you just focus on the same profile of people that you've been recruiting for the last 20 years. So I'm not saying you change the pool. I'm saying you widen it. Whether that means you don't just hire from D1s, by the way, because diversity is not just obvious diversity. Maybe you start targeting people who had a military background. Maybe you target, you know, parents that took a career break and are coming back into the workforce and they have a totally different perspective. Maybe you take people from different industries. You're looking at diverse backgrounds, diverse skill sets, diverse personality types. And again, you still have your required ingredients. You don't want to get away from the drive and the things that you know you need to be successful, but widen the scope and the pool to make sure you're hiring the best person for the job, because there's no way you can know that if you haven't widened your scope to evaluate the full community that's in front of you.
And you hit a lot of that. I do want to make a comment on what you said, but then also drill a little bit further, because I think there's part of that that I didn't ask the question the right way, but there's another element that I think we need to get to. First, the comment, you're talking about diversity of backgrounds, diversity of thought, military, people changing careers. One of the, I kind of hit a couple of categories here, which is mothers who stayed at home, and it could be father, it could be parents, but in my case, it was usually mothers who stayed at home that were rock stars, 15 years yep. ago, but they stayed at home and then now they're looking for an opportunity to come back in. And by the way, what I found is they're no bullshit. Like they come in, they work. They're not, talking about fantasy football for half the morning on Monday. They're like, no, I'm here to make money. And so it often drove everybody, I think, in a positive direction. So diversity of thought, diversity of background. But I think where we didn't get yet is, does it help the team perform better? And what are your thoughts there? Because what you said was, it helps. You get to widen the pool. But some leader is going to be like, why do I have to spend all that time widening the pool if I can find people more easily that are going to help me hit the number? It just so happens they all look like me.
Yes. So I'll give two answers. So yes, it absolutely helps you perform better. There's a million studies out there. Sheryl Sandberg in her book Lean In is famous for this. There's a ton of data out there that proves high performing teams directly tied to diversity. If you look at the diverse teams, they perform better. There's a ton of data out there, HBR articles. We can post them to this afterwards so people know that there's actually science behind this. And the best performing companies and organizations over time have diverse boards, diverse leadership groups. All of that's part of it. So 100%. I've seen it firsthand. Let me tell my story. This is the second part. My first year as I took over a revenue organization, about $200 million in kind of ARR that I was responsible for. It was about 5 years ago. I took it over. 20% of my leaders were women. And I had 7 open leadership spots. So I had to hire fast. It was April and our fiscal year ended in January. So I basically had 9 months to like fill the seats, perform, and like exceed records. And one, I didn't do it alone. So I don't want to say like just me and like I went after it, but I was very intentional that I was going to diversify the workforce and diversify my leadership team. By the end of the year, we had 60% leadership diversity. 60% of the leaders were women. Many of them, by the way, moms and new moms that had come back from mat leave that I like recruited and welcomed with open arms to my team. To your point before, I know how much a working mom can produce because they don't have time for any of the bullshit, which is fantastic. And then two, we grew the business 40% year over year that year. We attained and we did incredibly well. And we did better than the previous person did in the 3 years prior. And I'm not saying that was directly related to gender, but I think it contributed to it. I think it absolutely brought in new ways of capturing customers, new ways of sales cycles, new ways to engage customers or get them to open up with us, whatever it was. We got new connections. So what this was a cool one. A lot of times the customers we were selling to, there would have been like a champion our person had already worked with. They had some likeness together. There was a connection they had built through football or through a school they went to or maybe somewhere they grew up together. But there was a level of people that we weren't able to get to. We would level either the gender or the background or the diversity. So say, for example, one person had grown up in Italy. And then we found one of the executives that had spent a year abroad in Italy. Immediately connect the two of them. They're speaking a different language already together, right? So both literally and figuratively. There's when you sell to someone, you want to find them to connect on them like psychologically. How can you connect with them? And it doesn't have to be gender. It doesn't have to be underrepresented minorities. It can be something in your background that makes you different. And if everyone has the same background, most of the people you're selling to do not have that same background. So how do you diversify your team so you can attack your customer base in that way?
I think it's a great point. The people to whom you're selling do not have all of the same background. How do you match the talent to the task, so to speak? I think that that's a really good point. Hadn't thought of that. So I'm keeping you a while here. Let's talk about you a little bit. You're recently at MongoDB. I think you said you're into your third month. What attracted you to MongoDB, and what are you most excited about being? And by the way, what does MongoDB do for the audience?
Yeah, so MongoDB is a database company, and it's kind of a disruptor. It has revolutionized the way database as a service is operated. And basically, anytime you want to build an application, you need a database underneath it. That's what we provide. We provide it in a modern way, in a revolutionary way, in a way that scales faster than most of our competitors. So MongoDB is a very special company. It's about $1.3 billion in revenue and help a wide variety of customers. So there's all different types of companies that use us to build applications to make their businesses run better. The reason I was attracted to this company, other than it's a disruptor, I like companies that come in and disrupt the status quo. So I think that's special about MongoDB, that we're a disruptor. But the other, and the product really is as good as we say it is. But two is the leadership values are incredible, and they walk the talk, and they actually invest in their people. So one of the things that MongoDB is known for, and I tell people when I'm thinking about them joining, we invest 6 times more than any other technology company when it comes to learning and development. We truly focus on enabling and developing our people. And I saw it firsthand. It was my second week at the job, and we were taken off the phones to go do leadership training for 3 days, 3 full days, to learn leadership training. And it was a half day on culture building, a half day on recruiting. That does not happen at a lot of other technology companies. And it was refreshing. And it was really cool to see that like the advertising was real life happening. So the focus on learning and development really appeals to sort of my student side. And I see it in action here. And I think anybody who wants to get like their sales MBA and really develop and learn, this is an amazing place to be.
Wow. I think you're talking about leaders learning about recruiting, and what was the other
coaching.
One?
Culture of coaching.
Culture of coaching. Yeah. It's near and dear to my heart. So it's a huge problem. And I had Brent Adamson on, co-author of the Challenger Sale and the Challenger Customer. He was talking about how little time, how little money is invested really in that. And I think the stat from HBR is that less than 9% of the training budget goes into helping managers be better managers, how to coach, how to recruit, how to do the things that are in the role, like, you know, hire, develop, retain, right? Kudos to MongoDB. And I think it's important that you had your value system and you went and sought companies that fit that. Maybe just a couple of seconds on that.
Yeah, I'm a big believer that as you go into look into your career, and it depends on which stage of life you're at, but I always remind people that money and title is temporary. And you can go get a lot of money somewhere, but not get fulfillment or happiness, and you're sort of selling your soul for a little bit. And maybe you want to do that for a year or two. If you're at a certain stage in life where you're like, I want to buy a house, or I have a certain component, but it's actually refreshing that you can go work at companies and still make a lot of money and have financial success, but not feel empty inside. And it's very cool to see that at a company like Mongo. So when I decided to sort out and decided what I wanted to do next, I was very purposeful that I wanted to align with my values, which are impact, accomplishment, and equality. First, go find out what your values are. If you're not sure what they are, there's a ton of exercises you can do online to figure out what your values are. It helps tell your story. It helps you navigate what you want to do next. It helps you decide what projects to take on, career opportunities, all that stuff. So I had decided impact was my number one, and I wanted to have an impact somewhere, and that was really important to me. And so as I was talking to companies, I really wanted to get a test for, if I come in and try something, will I be able to do it? Do they align with my ability to make a difference? Back to your point on leadership training, the biggest way to multiply your success is through your leaders, because the multiplier effect is real. If you have a really great leader, and you know this, but if you have a really great leader, the seven people that are underneath them are going to absorb and have this ripple effect from really good leaders. And if they're not a great leader, they're going to kind of get small and not want to share their ideas and not perform best. My best example I always give is, you know, you have, and I'm sure everyone has experienced, Matt, I know you have, and I know I have, the sales leader who thinks yelling is productive, who takes the team in the room, and it's like, we missed the number, guys. And they like yell because it feels good to berate for whatever reason. They take the team in the room and they're like, we got to yell at them so that this won't happen again. If you've ever been on the receiving end of that, does it make you want to work harder or less? It definitely didn't want to make me work harder. You know, it didn't make me like, I'm going to go do twice as more now because this person yelled at me. It doesn't work. So as you go into those meetings, you have to think about your end goal first. What is the goal you want to accomplish and how do you get there? And if you got to yell, go yell to a friend or a spouse or a peer or a coach to get it out. But understand that, like, think about the goal you're trying to accomplish and become that leader. And I just found like there was an opportunity to have an impact here at Mongo at the leadership level. And I'm already been able to do that. So it feels like I've got a really good fit with my personal values and I'm growing professionally.
Yeah, the yelling and the hitting stuff. That's why I took up Krav Maga. It's probably better than yelling at people in the office. Let's as we close out here, we talk about coaching a lot. You know, my company is called Coach'em. So let's ask you. I want to ask you about coach. When you hear the word coach, it means a lot of different things. Who's your favorite coach?
Ooh.
Can go anywhere.
Yeah, I could go a lot of places. And I will go on a side tangent that I believe everyone should have an executive coach. I think even before you're an executive, you should get a coach. I've had one for the last 11 years. I like wholeheartedly believe so much in the value of it. So like just plug for executive coaching in general, go get one.
What you want to plug your executive coach? Give him or her a shout out.
Good question. I won't, only because I know she's not accepting new clients. And so she's going to get overwhelmed. But right. I would say find the person that you admire and find someone that you connect with at a value place. But also try a couple out. I think some people have tried coaching and then they're like, oh, it wasn't for me. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that's not for you. Mm-hmm. Just means that person may not be for you.
That person, it's very personal.
Exactly. Yeah. It's very personal. So when I think of coach, and this is probably not the answer you're looking for, and maybe I'll give you a famous one and then I'll give you a real life one. So a famous one in my mind is Oprah. I think Oprah is an incredible coach. And let me tell you why. I'm a little bit of a podcast.
She's real life. She's still alive,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. I like motivational speakers. I like Tony Robbins. I like Brene Brown. I like Simon Sinek. I'm into that stuff. That feeds my soul. It's not for everybody. The reason I've always looked up to Oprah is because she's all about teaching and fulfilling your purpose and finding out what fits right for you. And she always gives this whole pitch about, you know, she gives the idea of, it was the founder of a company called Beauty Bar, that like what she lived for was like facials and popping zits and plucking eyebrows. And she made a whole business out of it. Maybe your passion is baking and make a whole business out of it. Maybe your passion is teaching people, make a business out of it. Finding your purpose and aligning it with your personality is how you become successful. And I think I've learned a lot from like listening to her. The other one I'll give you that's super tactical.
Well, if I could just comment, obviously I know who Oprah is. I've never watched a full Oprah episode, but I know her. So everybody knows who she is because she's her wealth is measured with a B as in billion, yeah. and she's helped other people yeah. build their careers and into the millions and probably billions. So yeah, from a coaching standpoint, what's not to like about that?
Well, she's a teacher. And I think if you've ever listened to her speak, go listen to any commencement speech she has. She doesn't talk about her TV show. She doesn't talk about she talks about the lives she's impacted and how she's impacted those. Mm-hmm. And it all is based on stuff that she's learned because she's a student. In her talk show, she got to learn from millions of people, and then she takes that and she gives it back. One of the things I used just the other day, if you're in a rut or you're feeling down, or let's say you had a bad day for whatever reason, and you're like, ugh, like, I don't think I'm not motivated. The best way to get out of that is to give to somebody else. So if you're feeling down, go give advice to a young mentor or mentee of yours. Go help out your niece or nephew with their resume. Go help out your mom with her iPhone. I don't know. Help someone else and it totally fills yeah. your cup. And you don't have to, you could give financially. Like she talks about that a lot too, and giving to people and giving your time and your money, and like it'll make you feel better. But also just giving, I found when I would give advice or help people when their job hunt or whatever it might be, gosh, it fills your cup and it gives you a renowned sense of purpose and confidence.
Nice. And you're going to go, you said, I'm going to go tactical with the next
you have. Yeah. So I have a real life, a person I actually know. I don't actually know Oprah, although it's a life goal of mine to meet her one day. Maybe I'll put that in the universe.
Have you ever reached out to her?
No.
What do you think? She's just going to show up?
Maybe I'll share this podcast with her. Maybe we'll have a whole conversation about leadership. We'll see.
So check out the book that I'll send you about Brian Glazer, about the curiosity, and he'll inspire you to go figure out how to meet Oprah. But keep going.
Anything's possible, right? And then the other one is a mentor of mine that I worked for probably the longest in my career at Salesforce. I worked there for 19 years and I had 22 bosses in 19 years. So I was just luck of the draw. We grew really fast. I moved people around. There was one guy, his name's Tony Rodoni, and I plug him all the time. He's retired now. He's on the board of a bunch of different companies, but he was my longest running boss with over 3 years. Not only was he a true champion for diversity, and intentionally building diverse teams and empowering women in leadership and doing things like when you're in a team meeting and if you're the only in the room, you tend to be quiet. He would be a great example of being like, Christina, what do you think? And calling me up and then recognizing it. It sounds like a small thing, but when you're the only one in the room, you don't always speak up first. So it's just, he did a lot of cool tactical things. He's definitely a legend at Salesforce as someone in terms of careers he's impacted. But the other thing he did is he promoted me while I was on maternity leave. You know, he supported me as I came back as a new working mom. And not a lot of people do that, you know, and I wish more people would. So like my old lesson to leaders out there, if you've got someone on your team that's having a baby or their life is changing, be supportive, because like when they come back, the loyalty that you build when you do that right, oh, it's exponential. They will work way harder for you if you think about and support them as they come and reenter the workforce, whether that's after a 3-month mat leave or a 5-year stint with their kids, they have a stronger sense of purpose and it really can be game changing.
Yeah. Wow. That, and by the way, that loyalty is not just from you who was promoted while you were on mat leave, but it's the people that see that.
It's
also
a line of people out the door to work on his team as a result.
100%. And I don't know Tony. I'd actually love to meet Tony, but he's very instrumental in my career without realizing it, because he was instrumental in bringing Sandler into Salesforce with Guru Ganesh. Yep. And, you know, we kind of picked up along the way there. So, I know the name.
He's in debt, man.
Perhaps you can introduce
me. I will 100%. He's a great human, great sales professional, and just someone that I would love to live up to one day.
Well, anyone who's done what he did for as long as he did, to be known and talked about the way you just described him, and to be called a great human also, I'm sure we'll make him smile with a ton of pride. So shout out to Tony. Christina, as we close out here, any other advice for our audience? I want to be specific on this. Any advice for that solid professional, that business leader, that, you know, let's just say the guy who looks like me, who in his heart of hearts knows that It's right to build diverse teams, but having trouble connecting the dots and making it happen for whatever reason.
Oh. Proactively reach out to that fantastic female professional in your network, whether it's a first connection or a second connection, and go have a coffee with them and either learn or recruit. That's like my like tactical, pick one person in your network that you're like, oh, that woman's really great. She's the top performer at Cisco. I think I'll just have a coffee and see what happens there. You would be blown away. So like one, proactively recruit and ask. That's number one. Two, this is one that I always tell people that maybe have had a lot of experience and come from a different, this is my advice I would give to my dad, okay? Don't hold back.
I'm not that old.
No. Don't hold back recognition. Recognition is a currency. I think the old school philosophy of I'm not going to tell you you're good until you're really exceptional. And when I tell you you're good, you're going to know that it means a lot. I think that's dated. I really believe that recognition is a currency. And just like you give people financial bonuses, you should give them recognition bonuses. And don't hold back. Someone does a great job, go out of your way to thank them. Say how well they did. People are motivated, especially this next generation of professionals, are motivated in a different way than just money. And we have to think about recognition as a currency. Use it frequently. That's my second one. Third, as leaders, we have a responsibility to be good leaders. If you're unsure if you're a good leader, or you think you are because you're performing well, but if you ever surveyed your team or asked your peers, gosh, go do that. The way I think about leadership, it's such a responsibility. You are the main character in your direct reports' lives. They are talking about you at their dinner tables, on their date nights, with their friends. You are a main character in their life. Let's be responsible. Let's be better. Let's act like the main character and be the protagonist, right? Be the good leader that we know we can be. Because you have an impact on people's life. You really do as a leader. And let's have a good one.
So on that topic, long, long time ago, at the dinner table, I was talking about this one individual that was impacting my life, not in a great way at that particular time. Probably I deserved it, but my wife got like so pissed off, like hearing about this person who she didn't even know. Like she basically wrote his name down on a piece of paper and put it in the freezer. I'm like, freezing the guy out.
She never met him, right? Well, if she met him, she would not like him.
Anyway, so Christina, I think that's a great place to leave it. We covered a lot of ground. I love what you said about recognition bonuses, not just financial bonuses. We talked about bias for action. We talked about, building resume bullets through innovation. We talked about glass balls and rubber balls and the difference between the two. And we talked about Oprah. I mean, so we got it all in. We talked about the importance of building winning teams through diverse teams, diversity, meaning a lot of different things, and how to go about do it. So thanks for sharing your time with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to work with you, Matt.
All right. And for everybody out there watching and listening, thanks for doing so, whether it's on Spotify, whether it's on YouTube, hit the like button if you liked it. Let us know what you like. Let us know what you didn't like, and let us know what you'd like to see more of. We'd like to bring you content and guests that are innovative, that are actionable, provide actionable ideas, and of course, are also interesting. So again, thanks for all of you watching out there. And until next time, coach them if you want to keep them.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Coach to Scale, How Modern Leaders Build Coaching Cultures. For show notes and other episodes, visit us at coachem.io. That's coachem.io. And follow us on Twitter at Coachem Now. See you all next week. Thanks for joining. And remember, coach them if you want to keep them.